There are few things more American than baseball and the flag. This hour, the only thing we're missing is apple pie. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Fastball, curveball, knuckleball. Terry McDermott's new book is part memoir of growing up in Cascade, Iowa, part story of one incredible no-hitter, and part scientific breakdown of pitching. It's called Off-Speed, Baseball, Pitching, and the Art of Deception. I'll talk with him. Then, Blue Sky, White Stars is a new children's book that helps readers, young and old, see the American flag in a new way. I'll talk with author Sarvinder Naberhaus. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, a children's book that gives us a new way to look at the American flag. But first, a new look at the all-American pastime. Terry McDermott is an author and journalist who grew up in Cascade, Iowa. His latest book takes him back to a passion that began in that small town in northeastern Iowa and has stayed with him as he's traveled the world. It's called Off-Speed, Baseball, Pitching, and the Art of Deception. And he is with us from Los Angeles today. Hi, Terry.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
And I want to go way back in time to Cascade, Iowa, which is still a very small town in Iowa. And when your passion for baseball first began, tell me a little bit of what life was like in Cascade back then.
Oh, man. It was a very tiny town. You know, one of the odd things about living in a small town is that you actually end up knowing more people. You know literally everyone in the town. The day before I left there when I was 17 years old, I drove around town and named everybody who lived in every building. So, you know, in a big city, you don't know that many people. You know, dozens there, you know, thousands or hundreds. But it was, you know, there was no reason for it. It's a farm town. Very small. It's a mile long, you know, a quarter of a mile wide. You could see out of the town from anywhere in it. You could just look down the street and you could see cornfields. In fact, we had a cornfield right next to our house. And there wasn't much to do. We didn't have movie theaters. We didn't even have a library. So we had whatever we could do. And there, this seems so strange now. You know, I have kids here in Los Angeles. We would never do this. But we'd let the kids out. The kids would be let out in the morning and come back at night. you could run all day, do whatever you wanted, because it was completely safe in every regard. So to fill time, we basically played sports. We played baseball in the summer and basketball in the winter, and that was it. We didn't even have a football team at the high school.
And you loved baseball, but I don't know that baseball loved you back at that point.
Oh, boy, you're mean today, aren't you? Yeah. Well, you know, I was a scrawny little kid. My dad was the general manager of the local town team. Every town in that part of Iowa then, and still actually, have semi-pro teams. Everybody from 15 to 50 play on the same team, and they play other towns. And he was the general manager of that, so he was in charge of making sure the field was prepared, making sure there were enough players. So he ordered us, his children, to love baseball, and we did what we were told. When I started high school, the first day of basketball practice in high school, they had a chart on the wall to measure you, and it started at 5 feet, and I didn't make the chart. Oh. You know, so I was like 4'10", you know, I weighed probably 100 pounds if lucky. So when I started my little league career, such as it was, I mean, the first year, I didn't get a hit the whole year. I tried, if the pitcher wasn't very fast, I'd try to get hit by the ball or I'd just pray for walks. But I was just horrifyingly bad. I got better. You didn't mention that.
We'll get to that. We got some time.
Okay.
So as a kid, your dad loved baseball. Your dad played baseball. All of the kids in town played baseball. As far as professional teams, how did you follow them?
We fought. My dad was a Yankee fan. He was, you know, he was an interesting guy in a lot of ways. He passed away some years ago, but his professional sports teams were the New York Yankees, the Green Bay Packers, and the Boston Celtics. In the 1960s, 50s and 60s, these were the paramount teams in the world.
So he liked to root for the winners.
He sure did,
which
boy.
Is so, you know, many Iowans like to root for the losing teams.
Well, I'm more like them than
right.
him. But at that point, I had to be a Yankee fan. Didn't have a choice. And I was eager to do it, too, I guess. I didn't know better then. Now I do. I'm a Seattle Mariner fan, which has its own complications.
Right. We will talk a lot more about right. that as the time goes on as well.
Right.
So you listen to
games
on the radio.
So we followed it on the radio. Okay. Yeah, the radio was our lifeline to the world. There were two or three television stations, maybe. I think there was one in Cedar Rapids that started when I was a kid. I don't want to make this sound like the Waltons or anything, but we had a refrigerator box when I was a little kid. I mean, an ice box, literal ice box, no refrigerator. So it was like being in another time and place, which it was. The radio was what we learned of the world largely. And in those days, there were no, the closest major league team was in Chicago, so that's a couple hundred miles away. There was no team in Minnesota yet. And there was a team in St. Louis, which was further away but had a bigger radio station, KMOX. So we listened to baseball on the radio. And the idea of the sounds of the game on the radio have really not changed at all. And I can go in the car and just go through the dial, and I can hear a baseball game without anybody talking, just the sound of the crowd, the hum of the crowd. And so that thing, it got sunk so deep inside of me that I eventually became more of a fan of listening to baseball on the radio than I did a fan of baseball. You know, it was just this thing that stuck in your head forever, and you can't get it out. We were that cascade in those days was 100% Roman Catholic. They had German Catholics and Irish Catholics, and they thought they were really different. But the sound of the Mass, the Latin Mass, and the sound of baseball are almost kind of the same thing. It's this sort of hum. You know, it's this giant you know, it's this thing it's comforting, it's enveloping, it's warm, it's mysterious.
And you were part of a large Catholic family, but you were the oldest, right?
I was the oldest boy.
The oldest boy.
Two older sisters. We had seven kids.
And you write about one trip that you took with your dad, and this was incredibly rare that your dad would even leave town, but
yes.
he took you to Chicago. Tell me about that.
Man, you know, it was the strangest day in my life. I've had a lot of strange days in my life since. I've been in some odd places. But this day, it's the most memorable by far of my whole life. So every year, the Knights of Columbus, which is a local Catholic service organization, would charter a train, which I didn't know was possible, out of Dubuque, East Dubuque, actually. And they would get on the train and go to Chicago and go to a doubleheader of the White Sox and the Yankees. And my dad had gone a few times. We didn't have a lot of money, so it was a big deal to go. So he wouldn't go every year, but he went. And the summer of my 9th birthday, he took me with him. So we left town at about 3:30 in the morning, Cascade, and it was like in a 1952 sunburned Chevy. I mean, it was a black car that was turned red by the sun, that belonged to Buckminster. I had never thought of that. Buckminster Fuller. And we drove to Dubuque. It was a Sunday, so we went to Mass at the cathedral. First time I'd ever been in the cathedral. Went to the train station, first time I ever got on a train, took the train to Chicago, and the men, I mean, it's, you know, it's like 7 in the morning or something like that, and they've already got, you know, 55-gallon drums of garbage cans filled with ice and beer, and they're eating cold ham sandwiches and beer for breakfast. how Iowa. And so we go into Chicago, and I'm just wide-eyed the whole day, the trip. I was one of the few children along, And we get there and we take a cab, a taxi cab, which I had only heard of, to downtown Chicago to a restaurant, a cafeteria, actually, where for the first time in my life, I was allowed to order whatever I wanted. And I got chicken that turned out not to have been fully cooked. And my dad's words of advice that stuck with me forever, he says, stick to the beef, son. So we took another cab to the ballpark, and then it was a doubleheader. The Yankees, and it was just an astonishing thing. I don't think I said five words the whole day. And the guy sitting, my dad was sitting on one side of me. The guy on the other side was a local guy from Chicago. And he passed out drunk halfway through the first game. And it was like leaning on my shoulder. And it was a remarkable thing. And this is a strange thing. I remembered that in one of the games, Yogi Berra was the Yankee catcher in those days. He was a great, great player. And he caught both ends of the doubleheader, which would never happen today. I mean, a manager would be put in jail now if that happened. But Yogi caught both. And by the end of the second game, he was kind of tired. And a batter, I remember it as being Al Smith, hit a pop-up behind the plate, and Yogi didn't even get out of his stance, and the ball almost hit him. It landed right behind him. Should have been an out. Of course, Smith hit the next pitch out of the park for a home run. And when I was researching this to put it in the book, I tried to find that and some evidence of that foul pop-up, and I couldn't. I mean, there was a home run. I mean, Yogi did play catch both games, but I couldn't find the missed pop-up. And an early review of this appeared way before the book in March, I think, on a blog of a New York Times sports columnist. And within 15 minutes of him publishing it and telling the story about the foul pop-up, some reader of his emailed him and said, I was at that game. That happened.
So just, that day, I mean, every single detail seems to have stuck with you.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, going home, I don't think I slept for 3 days after that. But on the train back, your dad was talking to the guy next to him and he was saying that, I had my eyes closed, but I was wide awake. And he says, it was too much for him. And I was thinking, man, no, it wasn't too much.
It was just
right.
The beginning.
Yeah.
Well, and when you took that swing through Cascade and named everybody who lived in every house, that wasn't a nostalgic swing, was it? You were really eager to get out of town.
It's the strangest thing in a way. You know, when I've written about Cascade or talked to people about it, it sounds idyllic. And in many ways, it was. I mean, it was just almost purely innocent place, other than the fact that it had human beings in it. So how innocent could it be? But we swam naked in the river. You know, we caught fish and cooked them, wrapped them in mud and baked them in a fire next to the river. As I said, we played all day outside. We rode our bikes wherever we wanted. But, it's a small town, and everybody knows everything about everybody.
Right. You were ready to get out there and see the world.
I just hated it.
Oh.
I don't, it's just, right? I mean, now you would kill for it. And so I left town almost literally as the day I could when I got out of high school.
Terry, we're going to have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Terry McDermott. He's the author of Off Speed, Baseball, Pitching, and the Art of Deception. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in a few minutes, a conversation with the author of a new children's book that gives us a new way to look at the American flag. Blue Sky, White Stars is the name of the book. With me right now is Terry McDermott. His latest book is called Off Speed, Baseball, Pitching, and the Art of Deception. He's an author and journalist who grew up in Cascade, Iowa. And this book is part memoir. It also tells the story of a really remarkable no-hitter, and it breaks down scientifically different pitches in baseball. And of course, so far we've been talking mostly about that memoir part. And Terry, I think a lot of people who grew up in small town Iowa or in Iowa period had that urge to get out. A lot of us come back. So, I don't think you're going to offend anybody talking about that desire to get out and see the world. But you also, you kind of left baseball behind as well.
Yeah, I was one of those kind of kids who hated authority. And, you know, if you grow up in a Catholic town, you got a lot of nuns and priests and cousins and uncles and aunts. So everybody's an authority figure. So that's really what I was running away from. And of course, I did the absolutely smartest thing I could by joining the military.
Right, no authority there.
Yeah, right. I knew the first day I joined the Air Force. It was during Vietnam, and I didn't want to get drafted. So I joined the Air Force. It's a 4-year commitment. I knew literally on the first day that I'd made a horrible mistake, but there's nothing I could do about it then. I went out into the world and ended up in kind of weird circumstances for a long time. Spent a year in Vietnam, which was the first really big city at Saigon. The first really big city I'd ever been in. I mean, it was a big, chaotic madhouse, and I just loved it. I mean, it was like, man, it was like being at the circus 24 hours a day. And here I was, still then I'd gained a lot of weight. I weighed 145 pounds. so I was still this kind of weird character. The Vietnamese liked me because I was about their size. Unlike all the other huge Americans tromping around. But there was too much going on there for baseball to be relevant to me, it seemed. I played on the base team, played basketball. I mean, in fact, the field we played at, the baseball field, was surrounded by gun towers, I mean, which were theoretically guarding you from somebody coming from outside. But every once in a while, the Vietnamese gunners in the towers would turn the things on us just to scare us.
Oh.
It was really weird. I actually saw a Vietnamese policeman shoot a guy on a motorcycle because he ran a railroad crossing. It was just bizarre. And it was 1970, 71. The war was really already lost, but nobody had admitted it yet, I think. So it had this kind of really dyspeptic pandemonium to it. It was bizarre. Anyhow, it was more than enough that I didn't need real sports to fill in any blank spaces in my life. And then I came back, went to college, became a journalist, bounced around, worked in Council Bluffs in Omaha, and then moved to the West Coast to Portland and then Seattle. And in Seattle, I had this really great job where I just kind of wandered around the Northwest and wrote stories about kind of whatever interested me. And I started listening to the Seattle Mariner broadcasts on the radio when I was driving around out in the high desert, which is a gorgeous place if you've never been out there. And they had an announcer named Dave Niehaus. And Niehaus he was from Indiana, southern Indiana. So he had that kind of rural flatness, you know, but boy, that guy could tell a story. And I would listen to him just to have the radio on, to have a game on, have the sound. But he was so good. He just drew you in. And he actually almost solely is responsible for me coming back into as a fan of baseball after maybe 10 or 15 years of being away. He and Bill James, the great statistician, I guess. So that brought me back, and I became a Mariner fan of all things. They were horrible, but I didn't really care. You know, it was just great. In fact, the team was so bad, and they played in this horrible stadium, the King Dome, which was one of the big concrete domes. It was just depressing. It was more like a prison than a play field. But I had a daughter born the year I started going to the games. And so she was like literally in a little basket. You know, you could hold her in one hand. And I'd take her to the games with me, and she could take a nap. There was nobody there.
you had plenty of room to spread out. And
yeah, we'd take like 5 seats in the bleachers, you know. And she would sleep. But she became a big fan. Now, regrettably, she's in New York, and she's now a Yankee fan. Man, the sins of the fathers.
Right. Well, back to Grandpa's team.
Yeah.
So you have this story that weaves its way through the book in every single chapter. It's the story of this no-hitter. This was not a no-hitter you were in the stands for.
That's true.
But we watched this game, and which kind of speaks to the power that the Mariners and the game has on you. I mean, you were watching in your home office? Is that what?
Yeah, exactly. I was supposed to be working on this book. This is my fourth book. And two of the others are on terrorism, and one's on brain science. And so this book was supposed to be a break, you know, just some kind of a relief. My agent and I, after the last terrorism book, I was worn out, just depressed. It's a really depressing subject. It's interesting. It's important, but it's just depressing. There are no happy days on the terrorism trail. And we were talking about what to do for the next book, and I was kind of out of ideas, and he said, well, you know, I said, all I wanted was something that was fun and easy. And he says, why don't you do a baseball book? He's a big baseball fan too. He's a Mets fan. He lives in New York. And I thought, I'm a serious guy. You know, baseball's not serious. I'm not doing a baseball book. We used to call the sports departments in our newspapers the toy department. You know, and I wasn't playing with toys. I was a man, you know. And he said, well, what are you going to do then? I said, I don't know. Maybe Alzheimer's disease.
Also uplifting, said, yeah.
Yeah, he said, you're one of the stupidest people I've ever met. You know, for a smart guy, you're really, really dumb. He said, do the baseball book. It'll be easy. You'll have fun. You'll relax. Then you can go back and do something serious again. So I said, okay, I'll do it. And then it turned out I had a hell of a time. I need my conception of the book once I thought about it and sold it was to follow a single game and have a pitcher talk his way through the game and why they do what they do.
And really diagram the different pitches.
Yeah, and their strategy, what they're thinking. It couldn't be a retired player. It had to be somebody from the modern data era. So I could use the data and explain all of that as well. And I talked to maybe 3 dozen pitchers, and many of them would say, yeah, I'll do that. And then they would back out. Every one of them in the end backed out. And I go like, what? I mean, and what they would say is like, I don't want to give away my secrets. And I'm like, are you crazy? There are no secrets. That's what the data is all about. I could tell you what pitch you throw every Tuesday night for the last 6 years. You know, at 8:35 in the third inning,
well,
on the 1-0 count.
The data that's available today is incredible. There used to be secrets, maybe.
Oh, completely. Completely there were. I mean, it used to be thought sophisticated. Earl Weaver was a manager of the Baltimore Orioles in the 60s and 70s. I mean, he would keep records of batter pitcher matchups, and everybody thought, wow. You know, now, literally every pitch that's thrown in every major league game is dataized as it reaches the catcher. You can tell how it broke in two dimensions, the spin rate, the velocity at release, the velocity halfway to home, the velocity at home. You can tell the launch angle of the batted ball. It's just there are no secrets. You know it all immediately. But pitchers, athletes, professional athletes are superstitious. I mean, if you think about it, I spent a year in a neuroscience lab, and they're a lot like neuroscientists in that they do basically the same thing or try to do the same thing every day. Routine is really important. And yet the results are wildly discrepant. You know, they're different. Every time you do an experiment, you get a different result, and you go, God. So they're always trying to eliminate variables, trying to make everything as literally routine as they can. And then the results are still different. So they don't want more variables. And to them, I was a variable that they didn't need. Most pro athletes and most pitchers would be happy to talk to you for 5-10 minutes after a game. But to sit down and tell you exactly what they do and why they do it and how they do it,
that
was a little tougher.
So while you were looking for a game, this one just kind of hit you in the face?
Exactly. I was sitting there, you know, probably being angry about these guys being too spoiled to cooperate with me. I actually had one pitcher. It was Felix, actually. This game was pitched by Felix Hernandez, who was the great Mariner pitcher of the last decade. One of these phenoms who comes into professional baseball as a teenager. He's from Venezuela, and he was drafted when he was 16 years old. And just threw heat. You know, he threw hard. Could literally do almost anything with a baseball. He just had amazingly gifted. And so I'm watching the game and, you know, rooting for them and trying to work at the same time. And then it becomes obvious as the game goes on that he's throwing a perfect game and does. And at the end of it, I just said, you know what? I'll just do that game. I'll use that game. If Felix will talk to me, he will or he won't, I'm just going to do it. And so I got in touch with him through his agents. And he actually, the agent, not him, wanted me to pay Felix to be interviewed. And, Felix Hernandez makes $25 million a year. I don't. This might come as a shock to you, but writing nonfiction books, you don't usually make $25 million for the first couple years. You
right,
know.
Right.
So I went ahead and did it without his cooperation. And I talked to dozens of players, obviously, through the course of the research, and was able to use other resources to build the story of this game.
Well, and you analyze the different pitches. You break down the different pitches, which I'm not a big baseball fan. So it was fun for me because I knew the names of these pitches, but honestly didn't understand how they were different. So you make it easy to understand. You bring some of the history of the game into it too, which is really fascinating. I had no idea how constrained pitchers were by rules, especially in the early days of baseball. But one of the interesting things you write about is the relationship between pitchers and the other players. What kind of role do pitchers play on a team other than obviously throwing the ball?
Well, you know, you think about it, they're half the team now. There's 12 or 13 pitchers on a team. And they do, I mean, players will call themselves players, but they don't call the pitchers players. I mean, it's like they're a separate species. And the players think they're a subspecies, and of course the pitchers think the players are. It's an odd dynamic. In a strange way, you know, the pitchers are often the best athletes on the team. Most of them were, you know, multi-sport stars in high school. A lot of them are like, you know, All-American basketball players. So they're great athletes, but they can't hit. I mean, which is, it tells you just, I mean, even a superb athlete can't hit major league pitching if they're not an elite hitter. It's a really hard thing to do. And we could talk about that a little bit too, about how much time you have and don't have. But the pitchers are a part. And, you know, most pitchers don't play every day. I mean, a starting pitcher pitches one and a half times a week, you know, once every 6 days, 5 or 6 days. So they got a lot of time on their hands. A lot of pitchers are really good golfers because every day they play golf because they're not pitching that day. Why not? And a lot of them, when they go to the ballpark, they don't even put their shoes on. They're out there with tennis shoes or, you know, they jog around the outfield. They play catch. You know, most of the great stories that have ever been written about baseball, written by pitchers. They light one another's shoes on fire. they're sitting in the bullpen, not doing a thing, just hanging out, you know, and if it's a nice day, you know, they get a little tan. It's an odd way to make a living, and especially if you're making $25 million of dollars
right.
a year doing that, it's a pretty good gig.
So, I sense that this book became more personal than maybe you originally intended it to be. Was that a surprise to you?
Oh, surprise to my editor. You know, what happened was I wrote the book, and I hated it. It had all the history in it, but I guess I'm not gifted at history. I don't know. I couldn't make it come alive in a way that I wanted to. It was okay, you know, and there was lots of interesting stuff in it, but it bored me personally. And there was a tiny little bit of personal stuff in it, almost none, but a couple of little instances. And I was way past the deadline for the book, and I didn't like it much, but I said, well, what the hell? No, let's move on to Alzheimer's. Let's go back and have some fun. Sent it into the editor. He didn't like it much either. and he said, well, you know what? You know, I'm tired of dealing with this thing. Get rid of the little personal stuff you have in here, and then we'll publish it anyhow. So how's that for enthusiasm? Right,
yeah. Confidence building.
Right. It matched my own. So I got it back, and I said, no, I think he's wrong. I always think editors are wrong, so the big shock there. And so what I did was I threw out half the book, literally, just threw it away, and put all this personal story in it. I mean, because I wanted to make it come alive for people in a more personal way. And I knew these Iowa stories, I'd told them to myself, to friends for years. I knew that they had value and that they represented something. And, you know, to me, you're not really writing if you're not learning something about yourself. I find that the writing process itself is a reporting process. It's not like you go out and do all the reporting and then come back and do the writing. It's not like they're separate things. For me, when I'm writing, I'm learning. Because you're trying to determine how things fit.
Yeah. So what do you think you learned about yourself from this?
Oh, you don't want to know that.
I do. But I only have a minute to hear it.
Yeah, okay. Well, see, you're out of time. I'm sorry. I guess we won't get to that. I learned that I miss this stuff. I learned that really what baseball is about is community and it's the community that I missed. I mean, that's there's a trade-off when you go to the big city. You leave the little town behind. And even if you were eager to do that, there's a cost. You lose community. You're anonymous in the city, which is a good thing and a really bad thing.
Well, your love for your dad really comes across. Your love for your girls really comes across as well. And it's nice to see baseball connecting those generations. Terry McDermott, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, thanks for the interview. You did a great job. I appreciate you having read the book.
Absolutely. Yeah. Terry McDermott, he's the author of Off Speed, Baseball Pitching, and the Art of Deception. Coming up in just a moment, an even lighter read, we're going to talk about a new picture book that gives us a new way to look at the American flag. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. There are moments at this point in our history when it feels like the iconic image of the American flag is being used as a weapon. A new children's book gives us a new way to look at our flag and also serves to remind us that we are all one nation, indivisible. The book is Blue Sky, White Stars, and the author is Sarvinder Naberhaus, who lives in Ames. Sarvinder, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. And let's go back. I know it takes a long time to bring a children's book into reality, but when did you have the idea for this book?
I actually came up with the idea 5 years ago, and then it took a year to sell it to a publisher, and then it took 4 years after that for it to come out.
So what gave you the idea?
Well, I'm not sure, because at the time that I'm writing, or anybody's writing, the chances are it won't sell. So I don't particularly pay attention, you know, because I think, oh, this isn't going to sell probably. And so the only thing I can think of is the day before I had read a book by Karma Wilson called How to Bake an American Pie. And I think it must have stuck in my craw as I slept. And the next day, these words kind of came to me, and then they kind of came out of me.
Describe the book for us, because it's pretty spare in the words, but the concept is very powerful. So try to describe it for us.
Well, I don't write with a lot of words for some reason. I know my fellow writers are always saying, oh, I need to edit, I need to cut words. And I think, oh, I need to add words. So I know that's, you know, unusual for me, but I think it goes back to my songwriting. I started writing songs when I was 8 years old, and you tell a story in very few words when you write a song. And so I think that is what has carried over here.
All right. And as I mentioned, I mean, not a lot of words, but there's an echo of the words on each page. So the first page, blue sky, white stars, and it shows us a bluish nighttime sky over the Statue of Liberty with white stars. And then the next page says the same thing, blue sky, white stars, with an image of the flag, just the blue panel with the white stars. And throughout the book, we see this again and again, the juxtaposition of an American scene and the flag. You are not the illustrator of this book, but you conceived it clearly as a very visual book.
It is a very visual book. And when I write, I do picture things in my head. They kind of play out like scenes. And I think maybe that's why I can also use minimal words, because I know what's in the scene, and then I don't have to reuse or re-describe what's in the scene. I can just describe what isn't visually there. And that's what I try to do anyway. And I have to say, the illustrator notes that I sent along, which is kind of a big no-no when writing and sending things out.
Right. The publisher picks the illustrator. You don't get to have a relationship with that person, at least before the book comes out, right?
Right. I do not. And so I was not able to talk to Kadir. So I had hundreds of words that were illustration notes, but less than 60 words that were actually the text.
And Kadir Nelson is the illustrator, a Caldecott Award-winning illustrator. So it must have been very exciting to hear that he was illustrating your book.
Yes, he is a Caldecott Honor illustrator and Coretta Scott King Award winner. And yes, I was very excited when I found out it was Kadir Nelson. I had actually kind of been stalking him. Lucia had hinted at who it might be, and so I kind of Googled illustrators, and his name kept coming up. And so I'd go to his website, and I discovered he had done illustrations about baseball, spiritual ones about space, Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King Jr., and I thought, my goodness, he is perfect for this book.
The book, as I mentioned at the beginning, we see the images of the flag juxtaposed against images of the United States of America. But then you go on to, with very few words, tell the history of the United States. What was the important thing to convey there?
I do. I actually was trying to include more people than were included, but I was trying to think of all the different types of people in America. The farmer, which did not make the cut, Native Americans. I had wanted Sacagawea and perhaps Lewis and Clark. So I was trying to think of the history of America and all the people that kind of built it, you know. So that was kind of what I was thinking when the history, George Washington also got cut. But I think it is enough of an order that, yes, it does tell a brief history of the United States.
Right. So we see Betsy Ross sewing the flag, and we see Abraham Lincoln, and we see images of civil rights marchers. Mm-hmm. And we see a lot of diversity in
yes.
these faces. Although, as you said, maybe not as many people as you wanted to include. You yourself are an immigrant to the United States.
I am.
From India.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see Indian faces in this book.
I know. I was sad because they don't allow me to communicate with Kadir. And at one point I had in the images, I had said, you know, an Indian family wearing, you know, a sari or whatever in the images. But I think somewhere along the way between me, you know, and the process of getting to Kadir, it got cut. So I was a little bit disappointed in that, but maybe I'll have to write a sequel.
Right. Well, it's a very beautiful book, and it does show many, many faces of the United States of America. But tell us a little bit about your story, because clearly your experience as an immigrant is something that informs this book. When did you and your family come to the United States?
We came over in 1965. And I have a very short backstory at the end of the book, and it talks about my great-grandfather. His name is Bhutta Singh Ball, and he boarded a ship to come to America, and then he disembarked. And my dad remembers him telling him the story, and he asked his grandpa, he said, "Why did you get off the ship?" Because my dad wanted to come to America, and that was his dream. The American dream was his dream, and he worked hard. He got a scholarship in veterinary medicine, which ISU is known for. Came over here. He brought us. We were poor. We didn't know the language. We didn't eat the same food. We didn't know the culture. We didn't dress the same. We didn't talk the same. It was a very, you know, culture shock is a good word. It was very kind of a shocking experience.
And you were only 4 years old.
I was only four.
Mm-hmm. And Iowa has become more diverse in recent decades, but I also grew up in Iowa at about the same time, and there wasn't a lot of diversity. So you grew up in Ames, Iowa. Were there other immigrant families in your school?
I don't recall having any other non-Caucasian kids in my entire elementary school.
Wow.
I may have missed it, but I did definitely feel very different.
How do you think that influenced you as you were growing?
Oh, I think it made it hard. I think it made it hard in a lot of ways. Just, you know, being different and, you know, perhaps not embracing my culture as much, you know, trying to fit in, wanting to be part of the American culture, learning the American culture. But it was interesting then, once I got to college, to Iowa State University, things changed a lot in, you know, 15, 20 years. And people were thought that it was very wonderful that I had a different background. And they were saying, oh, you're tan, you're lucky you're tan all year round. And it became a very positive thing. And it just kind of shows how America has changed its attitudes.
And as you said, I mean, your dad was living his American dream. How did seeing that, experiencing that, and talking with him about that, how did that shape your idea of the United States of America?
I think when I reflected back upon it, and I think even subconsciously, because, you know, we learn by example. And so my dad, he definitely is my example, was my example, and will continue to be. And I hope then that I am going to be an example for my children, because he wasn't afraid to pursue his dreams. And so I kind of took that and ran and pursued my dream of being an author.
When you look at the flag, how do you feel? What goes through your mind?
The flag is a beautiful symbol. It is definitely a beautiful symbol. And I spent a lot of hours staring at the American flag because I was trying to come up with words that describe the flag for this book, you know, for the revisions. Lucia Monfried had called and she wanted me to add more Americana and she wanted it to be more people-centered. And so I really began looking at the flag closely and watching the flag. And I noticed it was everywhere I went. There's flags. So I think the American people are very proud of their flag.
Well, and do you feel like you look at it differently because you had that immigrant experience as well?
I think I probably do. I see a lot of sacrifice in the flag. I feel like a lot of sacrifice has gone into the flag because, you know, and as much hardships and sacrifice that people went through, it's the same level of richness and experience and reward that we get in the end, you know, in the comparison of the sacrifice to the riches, you know. The greater the sacrifice, the greater the riches.
This book is in no way a political book. I don't think it can be interpreted as a political book. But I do think back in time to 5 years ago when you had this idea, and there was a very different feeling in the United States at that moment. People were still foolishly talking about the fact that maybe we were living in a post-racial United States, you know, that the landscape had changed so dramatically with our first African-American president. And now we have had a lot of conflict that stems from racial division, ethnic division in the United States, political divisions in the United States. And you didn't plan to release this book at this time, but how does that change the experience for you?
The experience for me, I think, is different than it would have been if it had been released 5 years ago, because a lot of people feel like it speaks for them or it speaks on their behalf. And because of that, they are embracing the book. And I really do hope it is a book of healing for the nation. I hope it is a book of unity for the nation. I'm so glad you said it's not really a political book, because it is for all Americans. One of the phrases in there is all American. And I feel like this book is for every American, for the entire political spectrum, all the way from the left, all the way to the right, and anywhere in between.
The book just came out last month. It's been getting quite a bit of attention, a lot of really great reviews. Have you had an opportunity to interact with people who've read it, who've shared it with their children?
I have been getting a lot of feedback and positive response, and I've enjoyed it. I have friends and family send me pictures from all over the nation of the book displayed in bookstores. I have seen the Twitter feed light up. I have seen comments, beautifully written comments on Amazon that almost bring me to tears about this book and how it has moved them or brought them to tears.
So do you feel like it's fortunate that it landed at this moment in our political history?
I do feel like it was fortunate. I actually feel like it was supernaturally planned this way. It fell together very, very supernaturally, very easily, and the timing and everything, it just all fell together, and I believe it was for the healing and unity of our nation.
Have you had an opportunity to talk with the illustrator, Kadir Nelson, since the book came out?
I did have an opportunity. We had Kirkus Reviews called. They wanted to do an article about the book, and so I had the opportunity to finally meet Kadir on the phone and talk with him a little bit. We spent most of the time answering questions, but I did get to see a little bit of perspective and the process that he used.
Now, what do you feel you learned from that?
He also felt very similar to me about the fact that this book was for all Americans. And I really liked that we seemed to be on the same page, so to speak, with that. We were very united in our beliefs, and which, you know, since we had never talked, I wasn't sure exactly what he felt or believed or wanted for the book. But it seemed like we were united in that front, and I really, really liked that.
Now, as you mentioned, you are living your dream by publishing children's books. This is not your first career. For most people, it's not a first career, and it's not necessarily a pathway to riches, but this is not your first book, but it's been getting so much attention. So personally, how are you feeling about this moment in time?
I actually am a little bit conflicted with my emotions. I'm soaring high with all the attention and all the enjoyment that people are getting from the book, the meaning that they're getting, that it moves them, that they feel like it's worth their time. That all is very rewarding to me, because that is what I want people to experience and feel. And the other part of me is a little bit sad, because my dad, who is 90 years old, hasn't been feeling very well, and he's been in the hospital and he's been sick. So at the same time, I'm celebrating America, and I'm mourning a little bit with my dad, just because he's so old.
Yeah. But it must feel like a dream come true.
It definitely feels like a dream come true.
What is your next project?
My next project is actually the thing that I feel is my best writing, and it's also my favorite thing that I've written, and it's called Lines. And it is a board book for the young readers.
All right, and tell me what it's about.
Lines builds on itself. It starts out with a simple line, and I feel like it's simple, but it's also very complex, very